If you had the smartest Wi-Fi, it'd be Xfinity. It would boost speeds to the devices that needed them most and protect you from threats at home and online. Xfinity. Imagine that. Restrictions apply.
North Highlands, Sacramento.
This is Climate One. Religion can be a powerful force to drive human action.
What determines the behavior of people is their culture, is the upbringing, is their beliefs and their ethical values.
Leaders from all different faiths have been applying their core moral principles to the problem of human-caused climate disruption.
There is so much that faith communities and faith leaders contribute to confronting the climate crisis and to the climate movement more broadly.
And since a majority of the global population follows a major religion, faith-led climate action could have real impact.
So we all need to change and start thinking more broadly and inclusively of what our actions are going to do to affect others and to affect the natural world around us.
Faith in Climate Progress, up next on Climate One.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Shea Stevens. President Trump says his administration is preparing to spend $12 billion to help struggling U.S. farmers who are caught up in the trade war. NPR's Anusha Mathur reports that many farm policy advocates are hoping that the next step will be a more comprehensive farm bill.
The American agriculture industry is deeply intertwined with federal policy. Most of the government support that U.S. farmers receive is outlined in the Farm Bill. The most recent bill passed in 2018 under the first Trump administration. Vanessa Garcia Polanco from the National Young Farmers Coalition says at this point it's outdated, but she hopes for a new one next year.
There is still strong appetite to build those bridges between farmers and consumers in a bipartisan way.
The current bill is in place through next September. Lawmakers from both parties have been pushing for a new bill for years. Trump administration officials say that further agricultural reform is an administration priority for 2026. Anusha Mathur, NPR News.
The U.S. Supreme Court appears open to overturning a 90-year tradition that kept presidents from firing members of independent agencies. A ruling in the Trump administration's favor would upend the balance of power in Washington. NPR's Andrea Hsu reports that the court's conservative majority has already largely endorsed Trump's claim that he should be able to fire people at will.
Now, the Supreme Court, through its emergency docket, already signaled that it might create a special carve-out for the Fed, and it will hear arguments on that in January. But in today's case, conservative justices dismissed the idea that granting the president more powers would destabilize the government. Instead, they raised their own hypotheticals of what could happen if the court continues to insulate independent agencies from the president's control. What if Congress decided to give members 20-year terms? Why couldn't Congress just convert traditional cabinet agencies to multi-member commissions?
NPR's Andrea Hsu. Congresswoman Jasmine Crockett has launched a bid for the U.S. Senate. The Texas Democrat is running for a seat that's currently held by Republican Senator John Cornyn. KERA's Emmanuel Rivas has details.
In front of a crowd in South Dallas, Crockett said she's running to address the affordability crisis. The news comes after former Congressman Colin Allred dropped his bid in favor of running in one of Texas's newly drawn districts. In the GOP primary, Cornyn is facing Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton and Houston area State Representative Wesley Hunt. If elected, Crockett would become the first black woman to win a statewide office in Texas.
Emmanuel Rivas in Dallas. This is NPR. Tens of thousands of civilians are fleeing areas bordering Thailand and Cambodia amid renewed fighting between the Southeast Asian neighbors. Thailand launched airstrikes along its border with Cambodia Monday following the killing of a soldier in Thailand and the wounding of several others in new clashes Sunday. A spokesman for the Thai military says at least 7 civilians were killed and 20 others were wounded in the latest skirmishes. Thailand and Cambodia reached a ceasefire in July and expanded the air agreement in October during a ceremony that was attended by President Trump. Both sides are now vowing to keep fighting. The Indian government is reviewing a proposal to force phone companies to enable satellite location tracking, according to a report by Reuters. As Shweta Desai reports from Mumbai, the plan comes amid controversy over India's previous efforts to force companies to install surveillance apps.
Reuters reports that major manufacturers, including Apple, Google, and Samsung, have opposed the move due to legal and privacy concerns. It comes after the Indian government retracted a previous proposal mandating phone manufacturers to pre-install a state-run app that would have allowed surveillance of users. Rights groups have accused India of using digital surveillance tools such as Israeli software Pegasus to target opposition figures, journalists, and critics. The Indian government did not respond to requests for comments. For NPR News, I'm Shweta Desai in Mumbai.
U.S. futures are flat in after-hours trading on Wall Street. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Made in Cookware. Made in Cookware is crafted by chefs for chefs and designed for restaurants and home kitchens around the world. Their cookware can be found at madeincookware.com. This is NPR.
I'm Arianna Brocious.
And I'm Kushan Avidar.
And this is Climate One. All right, Kusha, COP30, the global annual climate summit, recently wrapped up in Belém, Brazil, and honestly without a lot to show for it. A lot of nations had hoped countries would adopt language, pledging to transition away from fossil fuels, but they didn't.
Arianna, excuse my French, but that is wackadoodle. We're talking about a United Nations climate conference, and the words fossil fuels didn't even appear in a final agreement until 2 years ago, and still world leaders can't agree to a promise to get off of them?
Right. There's a lot of pressure from oil-producing countries to not give in to this language. However, countries did agree to triple the amount of money promised to help poorer countries adapt to climate change, but on a slower timeline than many of those countries had hoped.
Yeah, I mean, it's disappointing to say the least, and it has a lot of people questioning the value of this annual conference altogether.
Yeah, we've heard that a lot lately. And, you know, there has been progress. We want to acknowledge 10 years ago at COP21, leaders in Paris agreed to limit global temperature rise to, quote, well below 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, with the goal of holding that to 1.5 degrees. This has been sort of the North Star of climate action, right? And since then, the rate of climate pollution growth has slowed. We've seen progress.
Yeah, and I'm happy that you brought up 10 years ago, because that's also when Pope Francis issued his landmark encyclical on climate. It's called Laudato Si. A lot of people say that document, which was a call to action for all people of the world to protect our common home, that it helped spur those world leaders in Paris to come to that agreement.
And that has us asking today, if political leaders are failing to take meaningful action, what role can religious leaders play? You know, a lot of people are hoping that the new Pope, Leo XIV, will follow in Francis's path. And the Catholic Church isn't the only religious institution that encourages its followers to care for creation.
A few years after Laudato Si, Muslim leaders issued Al-Mizan, which draws on principles from the Quran on protecting nature. And there's all these other groups, too. There's Dayenu, which is a Jewish group. There's Interfaith Power and Light, the Hindu Bhumi Project, and the Buddhist Climate Action Network. They all demonstrate this universality of the idea of creation care.
Yeah, and essentially that's just caring for the earth as well as each other, right? So according to the Pew Research Center, about 75% of the global population follows some religion. But regardless of your personal spiritual beliefs, one thing that struck me in putting together this episode is that all these faiths view action on climate and environmental sustainability as a moral imperative. And that moral framework, regardless of your personal beliefs, is something I think a lot of us can agree on.
Yeah. I mean, in fact, Rabbi Jenny Rosen, who I talked with, described the climate crisis as a moral crisis. So today we're talking about paths to progress led by faith traditions.
Let's start with Celia Dean Drummond. She's the director of the Laudato Si Research Institute and senior research fellow in theology at Campion Hall at the University of Oxford. She helped me understand what Pope Francis's encyclical, Laudato Si, is and why it was so groundbreaking when he wrote it 10 years ago.
what Pope Francis believed was that the climate crisis wasn't just a technical crisis that was somehow happening and we couldn't do anything about it. It was a wake-up call to see that actually we are responsible as human beings collectively for what is happening to our common home. And by the common home, he meant the home of all people and other creatures as well. And the people who are most severely affected are those in the global south. So he had a particular care for those living in the global south, not just because he was an Argentinian himself, but also because he'd spent hours sort of talking to those in the Amazonian region and other places, and he'd witnessed firsthand the sort of degradation that was taking place in some of those countries. So he's suddenly, as he said himself, he got how the ecological issues are joined up irreversibly with social issues and social justice questions. As far as he was concerned, the Western world was caught up in over-consumerism, indifferent to the suffering of others, including the suffering of all creatures and those who are being affected most by climate change. He also pointed out that technologies and what he called the technocratic paradigm was sort of throttling societies so that they no longer really knew how to act. They presupposed that our technologies would provide the solutions when actually it was a much deeper moral and spiritual problem that he was identifying. He was trying to push cultures in the Western world in particular to go through what he called a cultural revolution. I mean, it's a very radical encyclical in many ways. It was addressed not just to Catholics, but to all people of goodwill, including scientists. And there was more science in this encyclical than any other encyclical before or since, which is another amazing thing about it, because he was also a scientist by training, a chemist.
It's interesting because there's often a real or perceived conflict between science and religion. And so to have a pope who is a scientist by training really embrace and sort of advocate for that within a religious document is especially interesting. And Pope Francis was a radical in a lot of ways. He broke with tradition in many ways. I can think of notably his rejection of a lot of the trappings that come along with the papacy, right? Some of the kind of fancy cars and stuff like that. But when we speak about his leadership, specifically in climate and an environmental sense, can you point to a few specific examples where his leadership did shift policy or behavior at scale?
Yes, I think one of the most important things is the timing of when he released this encyclical in 2015. It was just before the Paris COP21 conversations and agreement took place. And I think that he did influence that conversation. You know, something happened in the Paris agreement that people weren't necessarily expecting, and that it went a little bit further than many people thought. Of course, he was also, like many others, quite frustrated with the extent to which that agreement has been monitored and implemented. And so when he wrote Laudato Diem, which was a sort of exhortation just before the Dubai COP28 summit in 2023, he expressed his own frustration that his comments about what Paris might achieve, you know, hadn't really done as much as he intended or hoped. But again, I think he helped shape the conversations on the ground in these international agreements. In addition to that, he also influenced the extent to which indigenous communities need to be taken seriously. Although many indigenous peoples don't think that their voice has been heard enough, they are now being recognized, at least in a way that wasn't the case, you know, 5-10 years ago. And I think that's not only down to Pope Francis, but he was one of the many influencers that pushed that agenda and said, we really have to listen to alternative forms of knowledge from those who have, if you like, found a way to live alongside and be in harmony with the natural world.
This year also marks the beginning of a new papacy. Pope Leo was elected in May. What evidence are you seeing so far that Pope Leo will continue Francis's environmental mantle?
Like Pope Francis, he's concerned for issues of poverty, and as he's also spent, you know, half his life in Peru as well, he was able to bind up that concern for issues of poverty with concerns for issues of the climate. The two are intricately linked.
Right.
He's said on a number of occasions that he's going to continue with Pope Francis's legacy, and so we can expect that. I don't think he'll introduce any more changes than Pope Francis has, but he's trying to mediate, if you like, within the church what Pope Francis intended.
You mentioned that there are tenets, maybe, underlying the Laudato Si and the way that Pope Leo has continued some of that legacy, and especially at a time when governments are falling behind on taking meaningful action. What influence can the great religions wield toward climate progress?
I think that always within a religious tradition, there are going to be some who disagree. But on the other hand, I think that they have the capacity to enable a kind of mass movement and also underline a deep desire for change and action that comes from a deep spiritual root in a way that's sort of distinctive for that particular religious faith. That sort of desire of that change of heart, if you like, that's possible within a religious tradition, that conversion, if you want to call it that, is an ecological conversion. And I think it goes very deep in the psyche of people who are religious.
Mm. Many climate conversations focus on technology and policy. What essential questions are we missing when we leave theology and ethics out of those discussions?
Yes, I think it goes a little bit back to some of the earlier parts of our conversation where the technocratic paradigm, as Pope Francis put it, isn't enough to solve the problem. It's enough to try and generate a sort of scientific solution. But if people don't come on board and don't endorse it, then nothing changes. And I think that one of the frustrations that many scientists have had, and I've spoken to a number of them over the years, being a scientist myself by training originally, is that, you know, why don't people listen to the knowledge? And the reason why they don't is that however much information you give people, they're not going to change their behavior or their hearts or their way of looking at things. There has to be something else that challenges them to move. And that sort of ecological conversion can come from a religious root. And that's why I think it's fundamental that theologians, you know, such as myself and others, actually, you know, helped people to understand how important it is to put issues of creation and social justice right into the heart of their teaching. If Christians start to understand that it's part of their fundamental Christian identity, it's not just an optional extra, then I think that we're going to see real change and real movement towards taking this even more seriously than it's been taken already.
If you could get every climate activist, policymaker, and concerned citizen to grapple with one theological or ethical concept, what would that be and why? Just an easy one.
Yeah, you got the sting in the tail at the end. I think all things are interconnected. So it's this weaving in issues of social justice with issues of ecology and seeing that as the fundamental insight that we need to grasp, that the breakdown of our relationship with each other and with the natural world has come from the breakdown in our relationship with God. So it's about the healing, if you like, of ourselves, of our relationship with others, our relationship with the creation, our relationship with God. And that's reconciliation is something that theologians have been pressing for centuries. But now it applies on a bigger scale to the globe as a whole. You know, we need to work for the common good. The science needs to work for the good of all and not just its own agenda. Nations need to work for the good of all and not just their own agenda. Individuals need to work for the common good and not just their own selfish consumerist habits. So we all need to change and start thinking more broadly and more inclusively of what our actions are going to do to affect others and to affect the natural world around us.
Celia Dean Drummond is director of the Laudato Si Research Institute and senior research fellow in theology at Campion Hall at the University of Oxford. Thank you so much for joining us on Climate One.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you today.
Coming up, Rabbi Jenny Rosen on how her faith helps guide action on climate.
Ultimately, the climate crisis is about closing the gap between the world as it is and the world as it could be, or frankly, as it should be. And faith, I think, is really also about holding strong to a vision of a world transformed.
That's up next when Climate One continues.
Thank you.
This is Climate One. I'm Kusha Navadar. Rabbi Jenny Rosen has spent more than two decades leading Jewish nonprofits that advocate for social change. She's founder and CEO of Dayenu, a group that organizes the American Jewish community to address the climate crisis through political action.
The climate crisis is coming more quickly and more furiously than I think really all of us had imagined. I think many of scientists are even sort of shocked at the pace of acceleration. I also think that the climate crisis is both a political issue. It's obviously an ecological issue. And I also think that it's an issue of the soul. We know that more than 80% of the American Jewish community is concerned or very concerned about the climate crisis. That's actually a statistic from a number of years ago. It's significantly higher now. And I think there are two reasons, at least two reasons, why more folks don't engage. I think one is people don't know what to do in the face of such a complex issue. And the second is that it is so overwhelming on a spiritual, psychological level to imagine what the world will be, what the world already is for many, many people, what it's becoming for many, many more of us, and what it will be for our children and grandchildren. And so I think there's a way in which we disassociate or look away and get busy with our lives because it's too much for our souls to bear what's at stake. And so as I was having my own realization about just how quickly and devastatingly the climate crisis was coming, how it is an issue of social, economic, and racial justice, how the Jewish community was not mobilized in all its people and power at the scale that's needed, I was coming to realize that we needed to create an organization and a movement that was addressing both of these reasons for inaction, giving people strategic ways to take action in community and spiritual resources to really make the space to confront the climate crisis with our eyes and hearts open.
Dayenu, I understand, is a big word in the Jewish faith. I want to talk about that word a little bit. I have been to a Passover. I am familiar with the term.
You've sung the song.
I have sung the song. But, you know, for our listeners, for me as well, I want to know, what does the name Dayenu signify in the context of climate action?
Yes. So Dayenu, as you referenced, is a really joyous song of gratitude that we sing each year at the Passover Seder when we retell the story of the Jewish people's journey from slavery to freedom. So it recounts all the things that God has done for us. If God had taken us out of Egypt but not given us the Torah, Dayenu, it would have been enough. It's usually how it's translated. It would have been enough. But it also means we've had enough. We've had enough destruction. We've had enough valuing fossil fuel companies over human life. We've had enough letting the impacts fall disproportionately on Black, Brown, Indigenous, poor, marginalized communities. Dayenu, enough. But there's also a double entendre, because it can mean we have enough. We have what we need to confront the climate crisis and to move towards climate solutions. We have the resources. We have the policy rubrics. We have the technology. We have what we need so that everyone can have enough.
Mm. We've had enough and we have enough. The Jewish tradition also has deep roots in concepts like stewardship, concepts like repair of the world. I'm sure that also informs your climate work as well.
Absolutely. The concepts that you mentioned of Shomrei Adama, protecting the earth, and Baal Tashrit, don't waste, are foundational, really Jewish environmental concepts. And I think there are many other values that also are profound, kind of foundational Jewish values that come to inform our work and the work of confronting the climate crisis as a Jewish community and as communities of faith. This is a social justice issue. So Tirdof Tzedek, pursuing justice, protecting the most vulnerable, choosing life, and at the most core, living Lador Vador, living from generation to generation. The very idea that the generations continue through time. And all of these really come to inform the call to take action in addressing the climate crisis and doing it in a way that also centers values like protecting the most vulnerable, like justice, like ensuring that all people can live and thrive.
This is getting to the heart of the conversation for me, because a question on my mind is what role religious leaders can play that other leaders can't. So for you as a religious leader, just thinking about it broadly, thinking about faith, what role can religious leaders play that politicians, scientists, activists can't as well?
This is one of my favorite questions, because I believe, as you said, that there is so much that faith communities and faith leaders contribute to confronting the climate crisis and to the climate movement more broadly. I'll start most fundamentally. The climate crisis, I said earlier, is an issue of the soul. It's also a moral crisis. It's about valuing human life and our planet over corporate greed. And the ability to continue, as I said, in Jewish tradition, l'dor v'dor, from generation to generation, and that all people can thrive no matter where they live. So protecting the most vulnerable, calling out real villains like the fossil fuel industry, lifting up the way the climate crisis disproportionately impacts certain communities, the stark reality of environmental racism that affects millions of people. All of these core moral issues, religious communities and leaders, I think, are very well situated to do this, and to do this grounded in values and teachings. So that's the moral voice, the moral role.
Well, yeah, to talk about the moral role too, I want to touch on that for a second. Sorry to interrupt you, but there's the trust there that I think is very important as well. Like the trust between a leader and their community to actually talk about these moral things, right?
Yes, yes. And to be rooted in community and to be rooted in a core set of shared values. I also think that ultimately the climate crisis is about closing the gap between the world as it is and the world as it could be, or frankly, as it should be. And faith, I think, is really also about holding strong to a vision of a world transformed. Some would say a world redeemed. And right now we need to stop terrible things that are unfolding, but we also need to envision a different future, what the world could be. We need the power to see the world as it could be and to truly believe that we can build a different society with a different energy system, with more justice, with more wholeness for all people. And I think this takes a kind of moral imagination to envision a different kind of future. And I think that kind of imagination of envisioning a different future and believing it's possible is the muscle of faith. And I think people need spiritual resources to grapple with the climate crisis, to keep our eyes and hearts open. And so another unique role, I think, for faith communities is to spiritually resource people to be open to what is happening, not to shield their eyes, avert their eyes, and for those who are working on climate to support them and resource them for the long haul. This is hard work, and to do that in the context of community. One of the unique added values that I think faith groups can play in the climate movement is that we can play both what I would say call an inside and an outside game. So raising up a moral voice, calling on our elected leaders to act in alignment with values, kind of being the agitating voice, and then to sit down with them on the inside, building relationships. If we have time for a short story.
Sure. Yeah, please.
Okay. So I think it was 2021, I and a colleague, a Muslim leader, were arrested together along with many others outside of the White House, where we were protesting with People versus Fossil Fuel, the way in which then President Biden was continuing to sign off on certain fossil fuel infrastructure. So we were literally arrested by Capitol Police outside the White House. There's a picture of us being taken away. There was also a reverend there, kind of the three Abrahamic traditions.
Right.
In handcuffs. Fast forward almost exactly 1 year later, I run into my colleague, the imam, in the gardens of the White House. We had both been invited to celebrate the passage of the Inflation Reduction Act because we had been organizing our communities. And I think in that is sort of a very visual snapshot of the way in which religious leaders and religious communities both need to be outside raising up a voice and a protest, and also people on the inside who are trusted and valued and invited in to really try to make change from the inside.
Yeah. It's so interesting to talk about that inside-outside dynamic that faith institutions can play. And I'm happy that you talked about the White House specifically, because, I mean, there has been so much happening from there lately with regards to climate. I mean, earlier this year, EPA head Lee Zeldin unveiled his plans to, in his words, drive a dagger straight into the heart of the climate change religion. What was your reaction when you heard those words?
Yeah, that was a doozy. Honestly, when I heard this, it made my stomach turn. Zeldin managed to denigrate religion, science, and the desperately needed life-saving efforts to address the climate crisis all in one fell swoop. I'm not sure what climate change religion is.
Okay.
But I do know that Judaism, the religion Zeldin and I share, values the protection of life. And that Zeldin's actions are profoundly and continue to be profoundly at odds with another Jewish concept, which is pikuach nefesh, to save a life. The values that we talked about of tirdoth tzedek, of pursuing justice, bacharta b'chaim, choosing life, all of these dozens of Jewish values that he is really denigrating. And even more pointedly, I think what has really galled me, it's not even a strong enough word, is the way in which he's lifted up Jewish values and practice while tearing down the foundations of our nation's climate protections. I don't know if you remember this, but he had this big public mezuzah hanging at the office of the EPA. So he's hanging on his office doorway a passage from the Torah about the foundational Jewish value of oneness, about keeping Jewish precepts front and center at all times. And this is what the text inside the mezuzah says, that we should pass them to our children. He was sanctifying the space with the mezuzah, holding this scripture, while taking a sledgehammer to the very things that protect human health and our environment.
Mm.
It felt like a tremendous farce. And I think as a Jewish climate movement and a Jewish climate organization, we feel a particular responsibility to call out the ways in which what he's doing is completely antithetical to Jewish values.
What does it look like for you when Dayenu's work really makes the impact that you want? Like, how do you know when you're on the right track?
We organize primarily through grassroots organizing. So we have Dayenu circles all over the country. We are raising up and training leaders, people who can move, as I often say, from angst to action. Some of those are folks
who've
been...
I love that. Sorry. I like that. Angst to action. Sorry. Go on.
Yeah. Because I think that's actually... We don't see our work as convincing people that the climate crisis is an issue. Probably at this point, close to 90% of American Jews, somewhere between 80 and 90%. And increasingly for all Americans, the climate crisis is... It's not a question of whether it exists. And actually, the fact that so many more people have experienced direct impacts just in recent years has driven home just how real this is. The question isn't, is there a climate crisis? The question is, how do people move from concern or angst or despair or fear or anxiety to action? And how do we ensure that that action is strategic and really making a difference? So grassroots organizing and really giving people meaningful ways, training people, giving people organizing skills, and designing campaigns that are strategic, that really focus on different levers for change. So, for example, we were one of the many, many efforts to pass the Inflation Reduction Act, the historic investments in clean energy, the very thing that Trump is now trying to dismantle. We had many public actions over the course of those months leading up, being able to get politicians on record, making commitments through organizing would be one metric. I think being able to work on specific pieces of legislation at the state and federal level is another indicator. We do a lot of get out the climate vote work with the Environmental Voter Project. And that is very strategic work to identify low propensity climate concerned voters. So these are people who climate is their number one issue, but they don't always vote. Getting Jewish institutions to screen fossil fuels out of their investment portfolios. So those are some of the external kind of indicators. And then there are all the internal indicators. How many new leaders do we have? How many more folks are being able to really take action and organize their peers to take action? Because ultimately, this is about people owning their agency and not just worrying quietly at home, but really coming together in community to take action.
Jenny, you've pointed out that Jews have faced existential crises many times in history and have survived. So how does that shape your perspective on the climate crisis?
I'll start by saying, you know, sadly, Jews do not have a monopoly on having faced difficult times before. I think like many, many peoples, Jews have faced annihilation and faced it in a way that we've not only survived, but thrived. I think some of that has been through the kind of envisioning and building a different kind of future. And I think some of it has been through how do we cultivate courageous action. One of the things we think a lot about at Dayenu is how do we support and encourage folks to connect with our own ancestors, whether those are our great grandparents who may have come to this country in hardship situations, having been persecuted. Is it our biblical ancestors like Shifra and Pua, who risked their lives to save Jewish babies at the time of slavery in Egypt? Is it Moses, who tirelessly confronted authority over and over again? Is it our ancient ancestors who embarked on the treacherous journey through the desert to build a better future? All of these are people in our own past who we're connected to, Lador Vador, generation to generation, who have faced existential threat. So as we face the existential threat of the climate crisis, I think we're really called to draw from our well of strength. And that includes our access to our tradition and our teaching and our values and our ritual and our practices and also our ancestors. I think we can all benefit from thinking about the generations before us and the kind of resources that they brought to do everything we can to secure a different future.
And you talked about this a little bit when you were talking about the work of Dayenu, but I want to put a fine point on the connection between faith and secular climate advocates here. So how can those two work together more effectively, especially when they may have different worldviews? I mean, I, for instance, am not a religious person, and I really enjoy sitting down and talking to you. And I think it takes all hands on deck to solve existential problems. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. It's funny you use that language, because I often say this is the time where we obviously need all hands on deck. And that means that everyone needs to bring their people, whoever their people are, to this existential crisis. This is something that no one group or one person can solve alone. The climate crisis needs everybody, and it needs everybody of all different backgrounds, because we can't do it alone and we don't need to do it alone.
In light of everything we've talked about, where do you think religious leaders can have the most influence on climate process looking ahead?
I think that religious leaders and religious communities need to ensure that they're raising up a moral voice, because the climate crisis is a moral issue. And how we respond to it has to be rooted in our deepest values and in a sense of urgency and cultivating courageous action, because it will take courageous and collective action for us to avert the worst of climate devastation and build a more just and livable and sustainable future for all people for generations to come.
Rabbi Jenny Rosen is founder and CEO of Dayenu. Jenny, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, at last year's Global Climate Summit in Azerbaijan, the host country president praised oil and gas as gifts from God. What does a Muslim faith leader make of that?
Everything is a gift. But of course, gifts cannot be abused and cannot be overused.
That's up next when Climate One continues.
This is Climate One. I'm Kusha Navadar. Our next guest has spent many years thinking about ethics, values, and spirituality in the context of environmental governance. Iyad Abumoghli is the founder and former director of the Faith for Earth Coalition of the United Nations Environment Program. He's also founder and chair of Al-Mizan, an Islamic approach to protecting the environment and addressing climate change.
Sustainable development is economy, social development, and the environment. However, what is missing is the cultural component. And the cultural component includes practices, includes religions, includes ethics and values. And that is important because what determines the behavior of people is their culture, is the upbringing, is their beliefs and their ethical values. Hmm. You know, 85% of the global population believes in a faith or a religion. And those have established centuries-old doctrines that inform them how to speak, how to talk, how to walk, how to dress, how to eat. And in all of that is related to sustainability and living in harmony with nature.
So it kind of sounds like what you're saying is that politics and policy can say the what, but religion can maybe say the why?
Exactly. And not only why in terms of how it is related to human activities and nature, but why are we doing good? Mm. Why do we have to protect nature, not all our own surrounding, but the surrounding of others in other continents? So we have a moral obligation towards humanity. It's a spiritual obligation that we are all in this together. The main concept of Laudato Si is interconnectedness between people and between people and the planet.
So let's talk about that interconnectedness a little bit further, because I think that's very well said. A few years after Laudato Si, you founded Al-Mizan, which means balance in Arabic. And I used to be a speechwriter. I love etymology, even when it's words outside of English. And balance is such a beautiful phrase there. Al-Mizan applies principles from the Quran to meeting current challenges. Tell me how Al-Mizan came to be.
Well, definitely, I would say immediately it was inspired by Laudato Si. And when I saw that, you know, 2.2 billion people believe in Christianity and they have something that is taken from their belief and their basic teaching. And I said, there's also 1.9 billion Muslims around the world. They have one book that they refer to for their daily lives, but also for their businesses. So the Quran is also a resource for environmental governance. So many verses in the Quran speak about specifically how do you deal with water resources, practices of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, specifically talk about how people should not waste. And in the Quran says God does not like wasters, right? Mm-hmm. So Mizan is a general concept in the Holy Quran that God has created everything in balance. Everything was created in pairs, in perfect shape. It talks about, you know, the skies and the earth, talks about the sun and the moon, and they cannot but by God's will change their courses and so on. So who are we as humans to play with that and change the course of things that God created? Al-Mizan contains also 50 other principles taken from the Holy Quran that relates to environmental sustainability and our relationship with nature. Mm. For example, justice talks about, you know, al-adl. Justice is something that drives human behavior between people and with their surroundings. It talks about compassion. If God is compassionate, why can't we be compassionate to others and to nature? It talks about al-fitra, which is how God created us, loving nature and living in balance with nature. So if we do live how God created us, then we do not unbalance anything that we have. So we took the global challenges that we are facing, and we related each one of them to, you know, what the Quran is saying, climate change, biodiversity loss, pollution. even economic systems that we have currently, and we related that to the economic system that was created in Islam using the words of God.
Justice, compassion, these are complicated, heavy concepts, and to find a framework that applies it to climate sounds so valuable. How is the Faith for Earth Coalition using Al Mizan as a framework for engaging Muslim communities on climate action?
Well, we're using both Laudato Si and Al Mizan because, you know, Faith for Earth is an interfaith initiative. We do not promote one religion over the other. Mm-hmm. We work with Hindus, with Buddhists, with the Zardists, with all types of religions. However, as I said, those two religions are the most established in terms of having something concrete, one specific document that we refer to. Judaism is the same, right? So we do work with Jews as well, but Muslims and Christians constitute more than 55% of the global population. So it's a great golden opportunity to work with both communities. So we have translated Al-Mizan into 11 languages. So we wanted to reach as many people as we can. And then we are trying to push the implementation of the principles mentioned in Al-Mizan on the ground. For example, the establishment of Al-Mizan Park in Jordan, which uses a concept called Al-Hima, which is protected area that was established 1400 years ago. And it details how people should plant trees, how they should do hunting in specific seasons with specific amounts for specific reasons. So it's a whole complete system. We're also using the ecotourism concepts of Al-Mizan in Tanzania, you know, to prevent over-extraction of resources. So there are many on-the-ground actions that have been adopted and implemented by a number of countries.
Iyad, you mentioned that if you put Islam and Christianity together, it represents more than half of the world's population, right? So
true.
In my mind, that made me also think they must own a lot of assets as well, including like land. So what are they doing to leverage these assets for environmental benefit? And maybe even after that, what should they be doing?
Right. And this is one of the main goals for the establishment of the Faith for Earth Coalition within UNEP. We looked at the wealth, let me put it this way, of faith organizations. And it is found to be the fourth largest economic power on earth.
Wow.
And they own 8% of habitable land on earth. If you want to imagine that, imagine the size of the United Kingdom. What faith organization owns is 36 times the size of the United Kingdom. So this is humongous. They own more than 5% of commercial forests at the global level. So one of the main objectives was to work with these organizations to green their investments and assets. First of all, most of the religions have principles for financial transactions and investments. For example, Christianity and Islam and, you know, Hinduism, they don't allow investment in alcohol production. Okay, this is a no-no. They don't allow investment in arms industry. But we did not find, except probably in Islam because it's more advanced in its financial system, principles for green investments, right? Mm-hmm. So we have worked with many financial organizations and many faith organizations to, first of all, launch a divestment movement. So we divest from investing in fossil fuel. But then again, after that, where do you invest if you divest?
Yeah.
You need to put your resources somewhere. So, of course, with the science and economists and so on, we're finding that green economy is the alternative. Mm-hmm. So we move to green economy. It's more profitable to the people and to the planet.
Are you saying that religious institutions should be doing more of that transferring of assets to the green economy?
Definitely, as investments first, but also as greening their own assessment. Look, there are estimate of more than 4 million mosques, more than, 100 million temples across the globe. These are buildings. And we know the building sector contributes to climate change.
That's a great
because
point.
It produces carbon, it uses water, it uses electricity, and so on and so forth. So if you green your house of worship by installing solar system, reducing water consumption, planting trees around it, using, the spaces for organic farming and so on, then you are contributing to reducing climate impact.
You're encouraging Almizan, to use a phrase that I learned before this, this interview. At last year's UN Climate Change Conference, the president of the host country, Azerbaijan's Ilham Aliyev, praised oil and gas as gifts from God. What was your reaction when you heard that?
Well, it is a gift from God. Everything that God has created for a reason. And everything is a gift. But of course, gifts cannot be abused and cannot be overused. Water is a gift of God. Mm. But if you consume more than what you need, then you deplete water resources and then there's nothing to drink or to run your industry or plant your trees. So everything has a limit. Now, I believe over the past 200, 300 years, we used it. We produced development, we advanced nations, but it's about time that we understand that we have used it more than we needed. Mm. Because, nature has a natural way of getting rid of pollutants, right? This is the Almizan, the balance that God created. If there is carbon dioxide, there are forests, oceans that absorb carbon dioxide. But if you start producing more carbon dioxide than the capacity of air, then you need to understand that God did not allow you to use that gift to that extent, right?
Mm.
So now it's about time that God also provided technology that we can use sun, water, whatever other natural resources to produce energy. Without contributing to depleting the natural resources nor polluting our environment.
Global religious leaders have been pushing for climate action at least since Pope Francis 10 years ago. So what can be done to get political leaders to listen to moral leaders?
We need to do more within the realm of religious leaders. We wait, unfortunately, until COPs. To organize a faith leader summit, and we issue a beautiful declaration that sets out the common values and, what we ask of member states and what we commit to do. But that is a moment in the history of things.
Mm-hmm.
What we need is a constant, continuous engagement with the decision makers and political leaders, right? So we don't leave it for a COP to happen and then we engage. We need to work at all levels, not only the high level, but also the community level. Faith leaders can impact the electoral choices of people, right? Don't elect for a decision making post or, a mayor or a parliamentarian if they don't uphold ethical approaches to the relationship between people and the relationship between people and nature. So it's a whole system that we need to create and move forward with, a system that works on a daily basis, not only on occasions.
Iyad Abumoghli is founder and former director of the Faith for Earth Coalition at the United Nations Environment Program and founder and chair of Almizan. Iyad, thank you so much for joining us and for all of your work.
Thank you very much for giving me this opportunity. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Likewise. Hey everyone, it's Kushan Ariana. It's the end of our show, which means it's time for Climate One More Thing. I'll start. Ariana, have you gone on Zillow like every other millennial and me?
Only just a few million times. Yeah.
Yeah, you get it. So Zillow is the world's largest,
platform for buying and selling homes online. And you know, Ariana, that at the bottom of most listings, they have a climate risk score that shows the likelihood that this home you may want to buy, could experience a flood or a wildfire. Get this. They're no longer showing those climate risk scores.
What? Why?
Yeah. Well, okay, so I read this in the New York Times. Zillow's removing those scores because representatives of the real estate industry and sellers of homes, like private sellers, are saying that the scores might not be as accurate as what is 100% verifiable, and that it might be hurting home sales. They're basically saying it's not required. Why put it up there? The company that provides those scores, First Street, which we've had on the show, says they're very transparent with where that has come from. They're verified by multiple independent groups, even if they're not 100% predictive. So I think it brings into question this weird tension between capitalism and what's good for the environment, frankly, because some folks are saying we don't want to hurt home sales, and other folks are saying we want to know if this home is going to experience a flood. So I thought it was a pretty interesting focal point of the state our society is in.
Well, no kidding. I mean, as we've talked about repeatedly on the show, this is real risk that people are encountering, and your home is often your largest financial asset. So you should know if you're going to be buying in a wildfire zone.
Yeah, and there's some nuance to it, so be sure that you check it out. But yeah, like, what is the real objective here? Ariana, what do you got?
Yeah, so mine's a little more uplifting. I was in Salt Lake City a few weeks ago, and I was at the Natural History Museum and found this really great interactive climate exhibit. Mm. And it kind of surprised me, because I feel like it's a thing I don't see that often out in the world. And it was very up to date. It had quotes and testimony from people we've had on the show before, like Catherine Hayhoe and Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson. And it even had this interactive screen where you could find your climate action through this sort of climate Venn diagram that I've talked about with Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson. So it's kind of like what you're good at, what you like to do, and like what's useful. So I was excited. I thought it was cool to see that, as I said, in the real world, and you know, right alongside all the cool dinosaur skeletons and other things they had there.
I love dinosaur skeletons. I feel like there's a fossil fuel joke in there, but I'm not clever enough to figure it out. Yeah, shout out to Utah. That's our show. Thanks for listening. You can see what our team is reading by subscribing to our newsletter. Sign up for it at climateone.org.
Climate One is a production of the Commonwealth Club. Our team includes Greg Dalton, Brad Marshland, Jenny Park, Austin Colon, Megan Basilia, Kushan Avidar, and Rachel Lacey. Our theme music is by George Young. I'm Ariana Brocious.
We'll check in with the BBC World Service live from London on the way next on KQED. Support for KQED comes from Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose philanthropy works to create a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org. Explore festive Latinx traditions at Piñatas and Sweet Treats coming up December 16th. The evening's going to feature edible treats, an excerpt from a play about piñatas, and hands-on activities. Tickets at kqed.org/live. Supported by Genentech. This week on Spooked, Lee's father, grandfather, and great-grandfather have all seen the man they call, quote, the shapeshifter. Lee can't help but wonder, is the shapeshifter perhaps coming for him? That's on Spooked. Find Spooked wherever you get your podcasts. Producers, reporters, and hosts of KQED Public Radio are represented by the Screen Actors Guild, American